You're listening to The Real Short Box, a comic book podcast made for geeks by geeks.
Welcome to the most righteous, most compelling, most authentic, most quintessential, and the realest of The Real Short Box. I am the doctor of pop culture, Kevin.
I'm Jared, and fuck those fake short boxes.
And I'm not drunk enough for this yet.
Well, it could be worse.
Really?
Yeah.
How?
Well, you know, maybe your voice just doesn't work anymore, or, you know.
Jesus, you went dark.
You could be vomiting drunk.
You're vomiting blood or something.
You can't even say anything.
Maybe you have ass AIDS. What?
Ass AIDS.
Jesus Christ, Kevin.
Oh, my goodness.
Go easy on me.
I'll go easy on you.
Come on.
But this is part 25 now of Marvel history.
Yes, today we continue our journey into the history of Marvel Comics, the depths of Marvel Comics. We're doing the Bronze Age, approximately 1970 to about 1984.
It's a good time.
A very good time, you know.
A
free-for-all. Interesting enough, fellas, we were born towards the end of this era. So we knew that, you know, our parents had a good time, or, you know, it was a time of social change, much like the 60s, but just taking it to another level.
You have like 30 brothers that you don't even know about, right?
I certainly hope not. But this was a period where comics really grew up. This is where they started directly addressing social issues. The artwork started going to another level as well.
Neil Adams, right?
Neil Adams is a perfect example. Jim Starlin.
Jim Starlin. He had some... I showed you one of those. He's some trippy shit.
Mm-hmm.
He's just like took a page right out of Steranko and Ditko's rule book and was like, let's just...
And then dropped acid.
Yeah. Drop some acid and go balls to the wall.
Now, what's cool is you notice for all of us who have these 70s books, the illustrations are more realistic. You know, you see the expressions on the faces when something happens. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's something you would see in real life. So you see that the artists were really taking their art level to just another depth of excellence.
And well, if you notice, they really did step up their ass cheek game, too.
Of course.
Like, everybody in the books had better ass cheeks. It was really interesting.
Ass cheeks were important in the Bronze Age.
Well, yes. You have to understand, some of these guys may have been on college campuses, may have been, you know, possibly using the drugs of the era, you know?
Yes, yeah, that's right. The late 60s, early 70s, things were cracking, coke was flying, man, everything was disco. Sorry, I'm in a different documentary right now. I'm like in a Cocaine Cowboys thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing, fellas, is the story arcs would have consequences for years to come. Because before, you know, you would have maybe a two-part story or so, and there wasn't really much to it after that. You know, the superhero moved on about his business, and that was it. But this time around, something would happen, and it would have consequences for years to come.
Well, you also had what we talked about in the Silver Age, like a character like Spider-Man, who was dealing with, like, it was the first time you kind of saw, like, real-life issues that were relatable. Now, literally, every title, cosmic or otherwise, had something that was, every character was like a real person, and every character was relatable, and their problems, even if they were, you know, Doctor Strange, you could relate to.
That makes sense. I related to Doctor Strange because he was a doctor, and growing up, my parents would never take me to one.
Are you serious?
And I always just wished Doctor Strange would appear and take care of me.
I prayed. Yeah. Dr. Strange, I don't even know what your medical expertise lie in, but could you please just give me a wellness checkup?
Yeah,
a physical, please?
This toe looks gangrenous.
Yeah.
Need some help. Please, give me a doctor. Dr. Strange!
Now, to get started with today's journey into Marvel Comics,
Start me up.
Start you up. One of the first events that occurred would be in 1971 with Amazing Spider-Man number 96 through 98, which I think we did discuss briefly in an earlier podcast.
We did.
We touched upon it, but it's really what sparks the Bronze Age.
Yes, yes, it definitely does.
We did not touch ourselves. After, maybe a day later, yes.
Oh, I don't know.
Speaking for myself, now. Wait, what?
Oh!
Basically, it involves drugs. Mm-hmm.
Drugs.
You know, the U.S. Department of Health and Education and Welfare, at the time, that's what the department was called, asked Marvel and Stan Lee to write an anti-drug story for the youth so they could understand the consequences of drug use.
Mm-hmm.
And Stan Lee said, yeah, no problem. So he decided to write a three-part story called Green Goblin Reborn.
Mm-hmm.
And and involved first a junkie, you know, getting high and thinking he's flying and whatnot. And Spider-Man had to save him. And then, but the main story was really about his homie, his buddy, his best friend, Harry Osborn, popping pills.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it has to do with like Mary Jane Watson, you know, having a little thing with admiring Peter a little too much, I guess.
Mary Jane having a little Mary Jane.
Yes.
Was Harry Osborn Green Goblin at this point?
Or no, no, no.
Just
no.
Old
I don't think
Harry.
So.
Okay.
No. It's still Norman.
Just came black. Later.
Interestingly enough,
with that hair,
yeah, that weird hairdo.
Yeah,
where did that come?
Salmon, I think. Does he have the same?
Salmon had the
as
same
well?
Thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, Norman at the time, interestingly enough, was suffering from amnesia, so he forgot Peter Parker's identity.
How
convenient, of course.
Yeah.
But later on, it would strike up again, and you know, of course, he goes at it with Harry, with Spider-Man and whatnot. And at the end of the day, you know, Harry's a drug addict for these issues, popping pills. And what happened towards the end was that Norman had to see it for himself, what his son was going through. And then he kind of just stopped the whole thing.
Right.
He had to stop.
But what we said before, though, mm-hmm. is the comics code, this was an anti-drug story.
Yes.
And still the comics code said no.
He said no.
You mention drugs and that's it.
Right. So Stan Lee and Marvel and, you know, they said, you know what? We're going to take our chances. We don't care. We're just not going to put the code on our books.
Fudge it.
And guess what? It didn't matter. It didn't hurt at all. And the comics sold very well.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because they still then after that put the code
back on
the books.
Right.
So, like, I know not too long ago, I mean, in our lifetime, in our 20s, mm-hmm. I think, is when they actually said, you know, like, we're going to break away from the comics code. And it actually became defunct because of it. Because
there's 10 people in an office building. Someone were like, no.
Right.
We were riding this gravy train
if
forever.
If I recall, I think Archie was like the last one, right?
Yeah, I think so. All the rest of them were just like, we're going to police ourselves.
Yep.
We're going to moderate ourselves.
Because we're grown-ass adults.
Right. And also it makes sense because in this modern era that we live in, most comic book readers, much like most video games, interestingly enough, are purchased from people in their 30s, 40s, and 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So comics basically just grew up. So now it's more adult material, more serious material. Because honestly, these days, not too many young children are reading them.
Jared's children.
Well, you're talking in the Bronze Age.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. 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 Oh. Now there's comics for
Wait,
literally.
Your children
everything.
Are that old?
Yeah. I'm a time traveler, you guys.
Wow.
Really not the podcast I wanted to share this. I wanted to do it on our favorite time travelers podcast. I was going to say me and then reveal.
So you're like
travel.
The Nathan Dayspring of our era. You just time jump.
I'm sorry.
Like
Professor Body Slide by two.
Oh, my goodness.
I prefer the Rip Hunter of the comics world here.
But yeah, basically, you know, it didn't hurt them at all. And this was the beginning of the end, although a very slow death. Of the comics code authority. It would take another 30 years or so, but if you think about it, this was like the first, and then interesting enough, DC themselves, a few weeks later, published their famous Green Lantern story with Speedy, exactly.
Yeah.
So was Harry Osborn first?
Was first, yeah. Yes.
Mm. Yep, that's
sorry, that Speedy. Not that fast, right. Asshole.
And it's funny because when people talk about seminal issues, they always talk about the Speedy one, but
yes.
No one ever mentions the Spider-Man one.
Right.
No one.
Right.
It's like they forgot about it or something. And I know it's primarily because of the covers.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because the cover, you know, Speedy, my ward, a junkie. That's on the cover.
My ward,
right.
A junkie.
That's what makes it so seminal in that matter because it was out there in your face.
Yeah.
Marvel kind of hid it a little bit. They were a little sneakier about it because
right.
they were unsure.
Wait,
DC was
subliminal.
Yeah, DC was just like, fuck it.
Well, it made sense because DC had to kind of sit back and say, okay, let's see if this works. If this works out, then we're just going to bring it. And that's probably the reason. You know, Marvel said, okay, we're going to ease it in. And then DC says, okay, you know what?
So many sexual references I can make right now.
But regardless, that incident is what really kind of opened the floodgates for some of the best storytelling that Marvel was going to have at that point. And
absolutely.
Like I was saying before, a free-for-all
absolutely.
As far as like character creation, types of characters, and what we can try now.
And this would know? Influence later artists like Joe Quesada. You know, he was a kid, his father got him the comics because he heard about it through the news or something like that. And then it influenced him to want to actually be part of the industry.
Oh, for
mm-hmm.
sure.
Amongst many others.
Mm-hmm.
And this would probably lead me to, you know, with this comics code, you know, starting to, the chinks in the armor was starting to crack. This would lead to a horror resurgence that,
yes.
that we hadn't seen in about 20 years at
yeah,
that point.
That's true. It did lead to a horror resurgence. It's funny because the comics code was still very relevant and still very prevalent in comic books world. mm-hmm. and way past the resurgence of the horror books. But what they did was they laxed it so much that it created, and you're right, a floodgate of horror-like villains and mm-hmm. characters. And a little bit about it was a number of the supernatural mystery suspense titles, they were introduced in the later half of the 1960s. And that would be like Charlatan Comics' Ghostly Tales, The Many Ghosts of Dr. Graves, Ghost Manor, mm-hmm. and along with Marvel Comics, their Chamber of Darkness, Monsters on the Prowl, Tower of Shadows, Creatures on the Loose.
Creatures on the Loose.
Right. Wow. Whenever we think about horror books, we always still think about EC, Tales from the Crypts and things like that. But a lot of these were important for a lot of different reasons. DC Comics at DC, the new House of Mystery editor at the time, it was Joe Orlando. He returned the title to its horror roots, mm-hmm. and I think it was around issue 175, if I recall. And it also introduced new titles at DC, a couple of them being The Unexpected and The Witching Hour. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these were being introduced and coming back to their roots because of in 1971. It even got more open and laxed. The Comics Code Authority relaxed some of its longstanding rules regarding horror books, and they said that scenes dealing with or instruments associated with Walking Dead or torture shall still not be used.
Right.
So they were adamant about that because that led down the slippery slope to EC. They didn't want that to happen again. Vampires, ghouls, and werewolves shall be permitted to be used when they were handled in the classic tradition, such as Frankenstein, Frankenstein's Monster, Dracula, and the other high-caliber literary works, like from Edgar Allan Poe, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, things like that, you know, from respected authors.
Which is why, and correct me if I'm wrong, because you're going to talk about Morbius, right?
Yep, coming right up.
Now, Morbius was, they had to call him Morbius the living vampire, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because they couldn't have undead characters. Like you could have a Tomb of Dracula, but you couldn't have...
You couldn't have
a modern day vampire.
Because Dracula was a literary piece of work.
Right.
Morbius was not. Therefore, he could not be a comic book character unless he was living.
Right.
Mm-hmm. He couldn't be undead.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. So they that's true. Marvel returned to publishing true horror by first introducing the scientifically created.
He was created by science.
Vampire like character, Morbius the living vampire. Followed by the introduction of Dracula in Tomb of Dracula. This opened the floodgates for more horror titles, such as anthology supernatural thrillers, of course, Werewolf by Night, the two series in which Satan or Satan-like hordes of hell figured, Ghost Rider and Son of Satan, were two more. In addition, following Warren Publishing's longtime lead, Marvel's parent company in 1971 began a black-and-white magazine imprint, which published a number of horror titles, including Dracula Lives, Monsters Unleashed, Vampire Tales, Tales of the Zombie, Haunt of Horror, and Masters of Terror. Additionally, Skywall Publications offered the black-and-white horror comics magazine Nightmare, Psycho, and Scream. Now, DC, during this time, continued to publish supernatural fiction and occasional horror stories in comics such as Ghosts, The Dark Mansion of Forbidden Love, which...
Terrifying.
Yeah, which was later titled Forbidden Tales of Dark Mansion, which... Still isn't the best title in the world, but better, I think, in how it presents itself.
Right.
They also had Secrets of Haunted House, Secrets of Sinister House, Swamp Thing, Weird Mystery Tales, Weird War Tales, which is one of my favorites, mm-hmm. Tales of Ghost Castle. Now, Charlatan continued in this vein as well with Ghostly Haunt, Haunted, Midnight Tales, Haunted Love, and Scary Tales.
Mm-hmm.
Underground cartoonists, many of them strongly influenced by the EC comics of the 50s, like Tales from the Crypt, also tried their hands in horror. Titles like Skull, Boogeyman, Fantagore, Insect Fear, Up from the Deep, Death Rattle, Gory Stories, Deviant Slice, and Two-Fisted Zombies, which I'm not sure if that was a sexual reference or not.
I thought it was going to be Deviant Sluts for some reason, too.
That might have been better. I would have picked that up.
Deviant Sluts.
So by the mid-1970s, the horror comic boom had started to fade a little bit, and only a few titles persevered. DC, Warren, and Charlatan canceled the last of their horror anthologies by the mid-1980s.
That's the thing with a lot of things in the Bronze Age, which was cool, and then they were trying a lot of new things out,
yeah,
and then like flooding it, and then it would disappear. Like it, so, like that's why some of those older issues, like a Ghost Rider, a Marvel Spotlights, all those books are kind of harder to find because there wasn't big runs of any of these
right.
things.
Right, it was harder to find because they were just throwing stuff against the wall to see what would stick.
Right,
and they were taking more chances because they had the ability to.
Right,
it's like when you're pent up in a cell.
Right,
and you know, and you're unable to eat only prison food.
Right,
when you get out, what's the first thing you want? You want a slice of pie.
Right,
you know, whether it be apple or pizza. You right. know, you want something that you couldn't ordinarily have. So all these writers were chomping at the bit to dive back into horror.
Right.
You know, or even just to dive into it for the first time.
Right.
Because they were fans of the EC and of horror back in the 50s.
Right.
So when they got their chance, they're like, please, 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 let me have a book. Let me have a book. So it was like almost a free-for-all.
Well, in the Real Shortbox style, I'll even say the Silver Age was like Marvel learning about masturbation. And then the Bronze mm-hmm. Age was their first ejaculation.
Mm-hmm.
And then they never stopped, ever. And they kept going and going and going. Yeah. And it felt great.
Now they just keep coming up with things.
That's right.
And canceling them.
Yeah,
so
now it's just...
I think they're stopping right before they finish.
Romance is dead.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry to interrupt, everyone. Just wanted to mention real quick about a shop in Canoga Park, California called Spiro's Heroes. Elliot, the proprietor of the store, has over 300,000 books in what's called the Temple of Comics. That's Spiro Heroes in Canoga Park, spirosheroes.com.
But to get back to Morbius, because it's an important one,
yeah.
He debuted in Amazing Spider-Man number 101, which is a beautiful book, guys, if you haven't seen it.
I mm-hmm. want it.
I know I have it somewhere in one of my boxes. It might be the one sitting
actually,
over there.
I think it's in Jared's box now.
It could be.
No, it's not. I'm going to my car. I'll be right back.
So that came out in October of 1971, following the February 1971 updating of the comic book industry's self-censorship board, the Comic Code Authority.
Right.
Lifted the ban on vampires and stuff. It was the first issue of Marvel Comics' flagship Spider-Man series written by someone other than creator and, co-creator and editor-in-chief Stan Lee.
Really? That book?
Yeah.
Who?
Yep, number 101. I'll get to that. Well, I can tell you right now, it was Roy Thomas.
Okay.
But he was busy writing a screenplay for an unproduced science fiction movie.
Yeah, and probably still unproduced probably. To this day.
So he bequeathed the series to his right-hand editor, Roy Thomas, and you know what would be cool would be to get a hold of that screenplay and to make the script, like make
Stan
it into a
Lee's
movie.
Unmade science fiction.
Yeah.
Film. Yeah, that'd be great.
That would be great. And one of the things that Roy Thomas said is, we were talking about doing Dracula, but Stan wanted a costume villain. Other than that, he didn't specify what we should do. Adding that part of the character conception came from an unspecified science fiction film of Thomas's youth, depicting a man turned into a vampire by radiation rather than magic. Thomas said the name Morbius was not deliberately taken from the antagonist Dr. Morbius in the movie Forbidden Planet. Thomas and penciler slash co-creator Gil Kane created the character as a man who is given vampiric abilities and traits via scientific methods rather than supernatural means. Kane based the character's look on that of actor Jack Palance.
Oh, wow.
Jack Palance is a cool character.
I know, right?
Cool actor, I should say.
Yeah. A cool character, too.
Yeah.
I thought that was a really cool thing.
I was just watching the first Batman movie, and I love that special line.
Number one.
Jack, don't forget your lucky dick.
Yeah,
man, I missed that guy.
And City Slickers.
City Slickers.
He was on a roll.
One thing.
Yeah, one thing.
And he was in a famous Western back in the day.
Oh, he's in a ton of shit back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. He was probably in a lot of our mothers, too, back in the day, too.
Well, speak for yours, brother, not mine.
Oh, no, he liked that dark chocolate.
You don't say.
Yeah, he was
Jack
a man.
Likes dark chocolates.
He kept saying to all the women, you're my number one now.
You're my number one vagina.
You know, him and like James Coburn, you know, they don't make them like they used to. Those are like some tough dudes.
James mm-hmm. Coburn. Dude, yeah. That guy had the voice.
James yep. Coburn.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there were some dudes back then. You looked at them the wrong way and they'd slap you with their face.
Slap you with their face, drink some scotch over your dead body.
Yeah.
And they wore their pants high.
Yep.
Yep. So Poor Morbius, he was a tragic and sympathetic antagonist in his initial two-issue arc, having acquired his vampiric addiction while researching a cure for his own rare fatal blood disease. So he collided again with Spider-Man and others in Marvel Team-Up number 3 and 4. He went on to star in Vampire Tales, Black and White Horror Comics magazine published in Marvel's sister company, Curtis Magazines, appearing in all but two of the mature audience titles, 11 issues. All but the first and last of these were written by Don McGregor, with penciling by Rich Buckler and by Tom Sutton, primarily. So, the poor guy, he doesn't have a great publication history.
No.
He did have a nice little 32-issue run in the 90s. From like it from ran the
Midnight
from,
Sun
stuff, yeah, yeah, it ran in September 1992 to April of 95. It was Rise of the Midnight Suns crossover story arc in their revamping of the Supernatural horror comics. And I'm going to tell you guys, I was never a big fan of those books growing up because the art wasn't clean.
Bad. Yeah, it wasn't yeah. good.
I think back then they were just pumping out so many books. They were hiring just like, yeah, hey, I see you can draw stuff.
Come on in.
Come on in. And like if a book had poor art when I was younger, I wouldn't even give it a chance.
Turn you yeah. off.
I was like, this just looks stupid. I'm not buying it.
Yeah, I was pretty picky on that.
Now that I'm older, the story is definitely more important for me.
Yeah.
But back then, it had to start with the art. And then if the story wasn't any good, after three or four issues, I'd stop.
Yeah.
But the art got me for those first three or four issues.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, this is stupid. I'm going to stop buying it. But now, you know, it's like I'll give it time to churn, so to speak. But that's the whole thing with Morbius. He had a nice little short run, and then he came back for a little bit. And he keeps coming back. I think he's a relatively popular Spider-Man character.
Yeah, he's got definitely like a fan base.
Yeah, I think it'd be cool to bring him into the movies.
Oh, for sure.
You know, especially with Marvel having a part in it now. It could be something very exciting.
Yeah.
But, you know, since we're on the topic of vampires, I wanted to get a little bit into the Tomb of Dracula.
Mm-hmm. Fuck yeah. Not, very significant issues within that particular...
Yes. For instance, like the big one, Tomb of Dracula number 10.
Mm-hmm.
What issue? Whose first appearance?
That would be Wesley Snipes character.
I love how you guys are saying Wesley Snipes' first appearance. Yeah. Yes, and that's how it should be introduced, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, because he was the first guy to show anybody that Marvel did have a reason to be in movies.
Mm-hmm. And that you could take a character that is relatively unknown.
A fourth string character.
Yeah. I mean, super obscure. Yep. And make him a movie badass. Star. Yeah, and make badass. Him a badass. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If anybody thinks, oh, what's Wesley Snipes' best movie? Everybody always naturally says, oh, Blade. You know, yeah. I don't know too many people that say anything else, to be
well,
honest.
Well, some people say...
Passenger 57, for sure.
Well, and I guess White Men Can't Jump and...
Jungle Fever.
You know, yeah, a couple of those.
I would say close second to Blade.
The one with Sean Connery, that's a pretty good one.
Rising Suns?
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, no.
Major League, I would say, would be a second one. Willie
Mays. That's true. That's true.
Wildcats.
Yeah. What?
Wildcats.
No.
The football movie with Goldie Hawn.
Oh, piss on that.
It's one of his first movies.
Yeah. Nobody cares. Nobody cares.
That was a Goldie Hawn vehicle, and that's all
yeah.
I would know it as.
Yeah. It's okay. Not Wesley Snipes.
Okay.
But he was good in... Major League.
Yeah.
Major League in that. But anyway, getting back to it. Tomb of Dracula is a horror comic series published by Marvel Comics. Came out in 1972. Ran until 1979. It ran until August 1979. It ended on the month I was born.
Really?
And the month and year, actually. So it ended.
That's a good run for that for a book, too, for a horror book.
Yeah, it ran 70 issues. Yeah.
Did they end the run because you were born?
Yes. That's what it says in there.
Said, all right, we've done enough. Donald's born. We're good.
Yep. Yep, we have another Antichrist figure that we can work with here. So the 70-issue run featured a group of vampire hunters who fought Count Dracula and other supernatural menaces. That's what I thought was the cool thing. While Dracula was the primary character, he was the antagonist of a group of vampire hunters. So actually, a lot of the story revolved around them trying to kill Dracula.
It was his own book was about him trying to be murdered.
Right, which is something you don't see every day.
Yeah. There was a very obscure, I had it on a bootleg DVD. They did a Japanimation, like the people who did the Robotech,
yeah.
Did a Tomb of Dracula movie.
Really?
And it's pretty bad. It was just boring. It's super boring, but it's super random that it even exists. Like, you can find it probably like a bootleg on like eBay or something like that.
But YouTube?
Probably, yeah, forget that. Just watch it on YouTube. I'm sure you could find it.
Boom.
Yeah.
Pretty bad, though.
Yay.
Yeah.
So the series, when it first came out, it did suffer from some direction, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, most important, the first year. And it's amazing it lasted as long as it did, because each of the first three issues was plotted by a different writer.
Ugh.
Mm. Though Jerry Conway is credited as sole writer of issue number one, the plot was actually written by Roy Thomas and editor Stan Lee, and Conway had no input into the issue until it had already been fully drawn.
Right.
So he's just basically adding, you know, dialogue.
Right.
So Conway was allowed to plot issue two by himself and wrote a story heavily influenced by the British Hammer films
of the
time. Yeah. So some Christopher Lee action going on there. A striking departure from the first issue. So people noticed. They were like, Jesus, this is like a big difference between issue one and two. Conway then quit the book due to an overabundance of writing assignments and was replaced by someone solid, Archie Goodwin, with issue number three. Goodwin then quit after only two issues, but also made major changes to the series' direction, including the introduction of cast members Rachel Van Helsing and Taj Natal. New writer then took over, Gardner Fox, who
Jesus
took the series in yet another direction and introduced a romance between Frank Drake and Rachel Van Helsing, which would remain a subplot for the rest of the goddamn series. However, Thomas, who had by this time succeeded Lee as the editor of The Tomb of Dracula, felt that Fox's take did not work and took him off the book after only two issues.
Wow. This is worse than Spider-Woman. Like, Spider-Woman had a bunch of writer changes.
Yeah.
But this is by far. This is like two issues,
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like the curse of two.
Yep. So guess who came in and saved the day?
Marv Wolfman?
Yes. Yes, he
Makes
did.
Makes sense.
Title gained stability and hit its stride with Marv Wolfman as he became scripter with the seventh issue. Though Wolfman himself has contended that he was floundering on the series until the story arc in issue 12 through 14, remarking, this storyline is when I finally figured out what this book was about. And that happens. You know, a writer, sometimes they just toy around.
Well, especially when you're handed a hunk of shit. Like, I mean, like, I'm not saying that because it wasn't good stuff from those other writers.
Right.
But to be able to, like, remold it into your vision. And
right, that's tough.
Yeah.
Had four writers before you. What do you do? The entire run of Tomb of Dracula was penciled by Gene Colan, with Tom Palmer inking all but number 1, 2, and 8 through 11. Gil Kane drew many of the covers for the first few Marvels, as he did for many other Marvel titles. Colan based the visual appearance of Marvel's Dracula not on Bela Lugosi, Christopher Lee, or any other actor who had played the vampire on the film, but rather on actor, again, Jack Palance.
Wow.
There you go.
Yeah, Jack Palance is getting some stage time here.
Did he play Dracula ever?
He did.
Okay.
He played Dracula in a television production of Stoker's novel the year after The Tomb of Dracula debuted.
Ah.
So that's why when he started on the book, he started to use him as kind of a visual reference.
Okay.
Yeah. Colan, he had lobbied for the artist's work on this. He really wanted to do it.
That's cool.
He said when he had heard that Marvel was putting out a Dracula book, he confronted editor Stan Lee about it and asked him to let him do it. He said that Stan didn't give him too much trouble, but as it turned out, he took the promise away, saying he had promised it to Bill Everett. Well, right then and there, Colan said that he auditioned for it. Stan didn't know what he was up to, but he spent a day at home and worked up a sample using Jack Palance as his inspiration and sent it to Stan. He got the call the very next day, and Stan was like, it's yours.
Oh, that's cool.
So he just drew it up real quick, and it impressed him. Another big appearance in this one for them was the group that would go on to hunt Dracula, and that would be Hannibal King. Yes,
yeah.
Thank you,
Ryan Reynolds.
Yeah, Hannibal King was the leader of this group of characters that would go out and hunt down Dracula. And, yeah, that became Ryan Reynolds. And they were actually, in the movies, they were going to spin that off.
Yep.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Into
their own thing.
Into his own thing. But the third one did so bad.
It was
horrible. Yeah. And a lot of that came to, I don't know if it was, it's so much a story, but also a lot of infighting.
Yep.
Yeah. Between
Goyer, Snipes,
the director,
everybody.
And Snipes, the actor / producer. Snipes, near the end, throughout filming, he wouldn't even talk to Goyer.
Really?
They would send post-it notes back and forth by carrier.
Well, that's a healthy relationship.
Yep.
Yeah.
That explains why it was like three movies in one.
Yep. Because Snipes had his thoughts on what he wanted to do. Goyer was like, no, I want to do this. But if I recall, Goyer had written the first two.
Yeah.
Right? So Goyer wrote the first two, and then he wanted to step in as director. And at that point, Snipes is like, no, I don't like the director. I think it came down to Snipes thinking that he could probably bully Goyer into something because Goyer wasn't a seasoned director.
Right.
Or thinking that Goyer didn't know what he was doing.
Right.
And also Goyer being an on-season director, maybe not exactly knowing what direction he was going in.
Especially choreography and whatnot.
Right. And double dipping when he shouldn't have been. Right. You know, maybe have handed it off to somebody else that's more capable. Right. But I don't blame the man, because when you're handed a project and they say, oh, do you want to direct your own, you know, stuff that you wrote?
Yeah, you're going to say,
well, yeah. Well, yeah.
The other big problem was it came out too fast, because the previous one came out 2 years earlier. So you can tell that it wasn't fully fleshed out. They just, okay, we got to start production. We got to go now.
Right.
And this is what you get.
Rushed. It was rushed. Yeah. So real quick, I wanted to mention just a few other characters.
Oh, yes.
Another important one is Werewolf by Night.
Yeah.
Werewolf by Night character first appeared in Marvel Spotlight number 2 that came out in 1972, based on an idea by none other than Roy Thomas. The series name was suggested by Stan Lee, and debut story was crafted by Jerry Conway and Mike Ploog. The character made additional appearances in Marvel Spotlight number 3 and 4, and then graduated onto his own series in September 1972, which was called Werewolf by Night. And that was published for 43 issues and ran until 1977.
It's a good run for that book,
too. It's a pretty solid run. Jack Russell, he's a descendant of a mystically altered offshoot of humans known as lycanthropes. During the night of the full moon and two nights surrounding it, he is forced to transform into a werewolf, a large, powerful form which is a hybrid of human and wolf, and loses his human intellect. Through a series of events, he is also capable of transforming voluntarily outside of the full moon, at which time he remains in control of himself. So it's kind of like an Incredible Hulk kind of thing, you know, that they did with him.
Now, do you think he was named Jack Russell as a pun?
Oh, like absolutely.
Jack Russell Terriers?
Yeah, absolutely. He appeared in Legion of Monsters. The Legion of Monsters, where they united Morbius, the Living Vampire, Ghost Rider, Man-Thing, and Werewolf by Night. And they were to fight the supernatural and kind of save the supernatural world.
Right.
So they wanted, you know, to keep outsiders out and fight evil people that were going to give them a bad name, so to speak. The other thing very important about Werewolf by Night, that it led into issue number 32.
Yep.
Which is a very important character for a lot of people.
Yes.
And that would be Moon Knight.
Not an easy book to get, kids.
Nope.
Well, at all. I know where we can get one, but it's going to cost a little bit of money.
I'll fight you for it.
I know you will.
Because it's here.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Written by Doug Monek, which with art by Don Perlman, villain hired by the Secret Empire. He was originally a villain hired by a Secret Empire to kill the title character in a two-part story continuing in number 33. Character proved popular with readers and was granted a solo spot in Marvel Spotlight number 28 and 29. So his first appearance was Werewolf by Night number 32, and then he first again appeared in a solo in Marvel Spotlight number 28 and 29, which again was written by Doug Monek and art by Don Perlin. So Moon Knight, he received his first ongoing series in 1980 with Doug Monek and Bill, I don't ever remember this guy's, how to pronounce it.
Sienkiewicz.
It would be Bill as its main creative team. Early sales were good for the book, leading to Marvel, as of issue number 15, moving the title from newsstand distribution and making it one of its flagship titles for a group of books only available in comic shops. A companion miniseries was also released, Moon Knight Special Edition, which reprinted the Hulk and Marvel Premiere or Marvel Preview Moon Knight stories in color and in comic format, as opposed to their original magazine format. Left the series after issue number 30, though continued to contribute covers until the final issue, which was issue number 38. And by the way, those issue covers are off the chain.
Yeah, Sienkiewicz is an amazing artist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, just really, really good stuff. Quick on the origin. He was born in Chicago. He was an American rabbi's wayward son.
American rabbi's wayward son.
I know. I don't know why that was important, but Spectre, he was a heavyweight boxer, a U.S. Marine, and a mercenary. He became a strong and skilled combatant and befriends a French pilot named Jean-Paul Duchamp, whom he calls Frenchie. Mm-hmm. And then while working for the African mercenary Raoul Bushman in Egypt, the group stumbles upon an archaeological dig whose crew includes Dr. Peter Arleron and his daughter Marlene. The dig had uncovered an ancient temple where artifacts included a statue of the Egyptian moon god Khonsu. Intent on looting the dig, Bushman kills Dr. Arleron. In response to Arleron's murder, Spectre challenges Bushman to personal combat and is defeated by Bushman and left to die in sub-zero temperature the desert night. Roaming Egyptians who worship the ancient Egyptian gods find Spectre and carry him to their temple. Helpless before the statue of Khonsu, Spectre's heart stops. Khonsu appears to him in a vision, offering Spectre a second chance at life if he becomes the god's avatar on Earth. Spectre awakens, wraps himself with silver shroud that covers his Khonsu's statue, and again confronts Bushman. He defeats him and returns to America with Marlene, Frenchie, and the statue of Khonsu. Then he decides to become a crime fighter, also known as Moon Knight. Therefore, Mark Spector becomes the Moon Knight. Then later on, we get into a little bit about how he has a bit of a problem. And this is, to me, to my knowledge, this is one of the earlier figures that is known for having a mental disorder.
Yeah.
And I think it's important
to
highlight that. And I'm sorry I'm taking a little bit on this, but...
No.
I think it's important to highlight that he's a functional member of society and a fudging superhero.
Yeah.
He fights crime. He's got a dissociative identity disorder. So there's multiple personalities there. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes he's like, I think he's a cabbie.
He's a cab driver, yeah.
Yeah.
Started out, I think, as like disguises, but then they started realizing it's like their actual personality.
Right, which is very clever for someone to change that idea to be like, oh, well, there wasn't actually these people there at all.
Yeah.
That was all in his head.
Mm-hmm.
That's like a Usual Suspects twist
if
you've ever seen one, you know, or written
Moon Knight is Kaiser Sose.
Right, mm-hmm. Pretty much.
Yeah.
So it's very clever, very smart book. Highly recommend if no one's read Moon Knight or any of these other horror books that you please do so. And that pretty much leads us from the horror into a little bit more of social injustice, and I think that one we're going to leave for part two
of the Bronze Age, because guys, we cannot fit all this lovely stuff in. We tried to do it with Silver Age, that became a two-parter, and this will be a two-parter. But you know why? It's because we love you and we want you to get all the fun facts, because we are a show about fun facts and sexual innuendo or blatant sexual talk.
Definitely,
we just want to get things right.
So as always, subscribe to us on iTunes, subscribe to us on Facebook, follow us there, Instagram, Twitter. Are we on Twitter?
Yeah.
We're on Twitter. If you subscribe to us on iTunes, please rate and review us, you know, hopefully with a nice review. Because that's how
you
people
suck.
Hear about us, and it's nice. So with that, we're gonna see you for part two of the Bronze Age.
Yep.
But we're gonna see you first at the comic shop.
This has been The Real Short Box. We'll see you at the comic shop. Thanks for listening.